But I want us to look and reflect for a few moments on what I'm calling the religious landscape of Europe. This is the context in which we do our kingdom work. And it's quite a complex landscape we're laboring in. I'm someone who likes a one-shoe-fits-all kind of approach to life, but it just doesn't work when it comes to understanding the context. And I think we've got to grapple with our context. And I actually think what's going on in a very overt way now is it's a real struggle for the heart of Europe. And we're in that struggle to define the heart of this civilization. And I think it's a religious struggle at the end of the day. That's what we're functioning in. So I'm going to go through this quite quickly so I don't overwhelm you, and let's just get into the conversation. I think there are three main players in the religious landscape of Europe today. So it's a simplification, but I think if we understand these three main players, it'll help us to grapple with context. So we have Christianity, we have Islam, and we have secular humanism. Those are the three main big players. Now, there's a history behind this context that we're in here in the 21st century. And it's helpful to have an outline of the history as we think about the religious landscape. So the first of these three players I've mentioned, the first to appear is Christianity. Jerusalem, Samaria, to the ends of the earth, around the Mediterranean basin, but quite quickly spreading into Europe. And it came into Europe as a minority religion when paganism was dominant. And then in a remarkable series of events, it became the religion of Europe from the 5th century onwards. And this was largely consolidated in the Edict of Milan, rubber stamped by Constantine, which actually opened up remarkable opportunities for Christianity, had a huge and enduring influence, but I think it came at a cost too. But we're not going to get into that this afternoon. Many of you will know the name Tom Holland, an English historian. He writes historic epics. Thick, but he's a good storyteller and a good historian. And I think it's still his latest, his book, Dominion. Here's someone who's not of the faith, but deeply sympathetic as he wrestles with Europe's history. And for him, it became a discovery. He calls it his discovery over a period of decades, just how influential Christianity is to Europe right across the board in the political, cultural, intellectual life of the continent. And Holland's going against the grain, which is that Christianity is the reason for all the bad around us. He's saying this is nonsense. He said it's the cause of so much of the good. So Christianity comes in first. The second player on the scene is Islam. Islam comes into Europe via North Africa. The invasion of Spain by the Moors in the 8th century is when the first dominant presence of Islam comes to the soil of the European continent. Repeatedly pushed back, but they actually occupied parts of Spain into the 15th century, which we think is a long time ago. It's not. It's still yesterday in terms of our larger historical understanding. And then through the Middle Ages, we have the Crusades, which span from the 11th century to the 15th century. Here's a really brutal contest between Christians and the followers of Muhammad. Say no more on that. And then the Ottoman Empire, which is Islamic, out of Turkey. This is a major threat to Europe for hundreds of years. And it's interesting, at the turn of the millennium, many state leaders saw Islam as a threat to European states. And as late as the 15th century, 16th century, Thomas Cranmer, our great English reformational figure, wrote our famous prayer book for the Anglican Church, which had collect set prayers. And many of the collects have, save us from the Turks and the infidels. 16th century, interesting. So real threat on our soil. And the turning point is 1683, when Vienna is actually liberated The Ottomans almost take over Vienna, and they're liberated. And it wasn't until the 18th century, with the rise of the great European colonizers, empires, that the threat of Islam was really overcome. British colonized India, the French colonized North Africa. These become holdings in various empires. And that's the potted history. I said it was going to be brief. Okay, Christianity first. This is how Islam gets into the picture, into the story. Then we have the third player that I mentioned, which is secular humanism. Now, this is a very complex history. I'm telling it to you in 10 minutes. I mean, this is thousands of hours of lecturing by historians far more able than me. So I'm just giving the outline. Secular humanism, it doesn't start as secular humanism. There's many iterations of humanism, but it's a new way of seeing things. And it actually leads to the displacement of God from the center and the enthroning of man, of humans, humanism. And I think we can call it a religion. It's a religion of the self, a religious trust in our ability to micromanage the whole universe, to mitigate against risk, and to sort out problems through the application of techniques, the techniques that we invent and new technologies that we come up with. It's an immense form of trust in human ability to mastermind salvation. It has its own sin salvation narrative. And this humanism has become very dominant, especially the secular side of humanism. And this has actually really displaced Christianity. Now, it's still a fight. Tom Holland says it's not as bad as you think it is. I here don't agree with Tom Holland. He says because the roots are Christian, every form of secularism is just a bastardized child of Christianity. I'm not convinced of that argument. I have some sympathy, but I actually think we are seeing the removal of the roots. The foundations are being destroyed. And what's significant about the rise of secular humanism is that in the 18th century, philosophy transferred its allegiance, which was to religion, to science. So philosophy, in a sense, bowed ultimately to religious commitments and ideas, and it transferred then its allegiance to science in the 18th century. And why we call it secular humanism is because this form of humanism has a strong commitment to eradicate all religion from the public square. It's a key part of secular humanism. We need to privatize religion. Best if we got rid of it altogether, but if it's going to exist, it must be in the private sphere. Another thing on the religious commitment of secular humanism, its faith is in progress. It's a deep faith commitment to progress, which is the present is better than the past. So it tends to look back. Things were worse back then. We're in a better place, and the future will be better than the present. C.S. Lewis called this chronological snobbery. And it's at the heart of the religious commitment of the secular humanist. So this is the new and progressive ideology that dominates Europe. And it's led to the marginalization of Christianity. And it is so successful that Europe is now the most secular continent in the world. However, in the last 60-odd years, and continuing to accelerate as a trend, this secular continent has seen a religious comeback. And the big one is from the previous contender. Islam is back on the scene. It's one of the players in terms of religious landscape. And Islam is causing huge shifts in this religious landscape. And we're still trying to figure out the implications. And it's important to say here, Islam, Muslims, didn't come in the last 60 years as an invading horde. We invited them. We said, please come. There's a labor shortage in the post-war period. We look to our colonies. If we were English, British, we look to India, Pakistan. If you were French, you'd look to Algeria, other North African countries. Please come and work in our factories. And it's interesting, historians now can look back in the post-war period, especially the 50s and 60s when they came. Our expectation is they'd make money and go home. Well, they didn't go home, and why should they have gone home? They made a life for themselves here. We invited them, but in our minds, they were guests. It wasn't made official, but there was a real expectation. We really thought they would go home, but they didn't. We invited them, they stayed, and for that reason, we have a huge Islamic presence in this landscape. And we'll get to this in a moment. What Muslim peoples are doing within Europe and have been doing for 50 years is having lots of babies, where we've stopped having babies. We're not even maintaining our population figures. So Islam now has reached a population density where they're a real significant minority. Still a minority, but they're significant. So this is what I call the story of Islam's second sojourn in terms of the European continent. If you look at Europe from Ireland across to Russia, back in the 1970s, there were 18 million Muslims. In the 2000s, there's about 40. So that's a really steep rise, 18 to 40 million, about doubled. Interestingly enough, Russia has the largest Islamic population, between 10 and 14%. And if the 15 million Muslims who are in Western Europe were a nation, they'd be within the top 20 of the European Union. So that's a significant number. Now, this population density is having a significant impact on the religious climate of this continent. Back in the 1970s, this is kind of funny, the academics do their work and they're so sure as they predict futures. One of the predictions was the secularization of Europe. And by secularization, they meant that the public square will be totally naked. The naked public square. Naked of what? Shorn of all religions. There'll be nothing of a religious dimension within the public square. Secular humanism will rule. But the fact is, it doesn't. Religion is in the mix. Just keep your eyes and ears open for newscasting about European events. So much of it is around religion. The dream of the naked public square really, really failed. Another change that's occurred in the last 20 years, which is really important to grasp, is a change of identity in terms of being Islamic here. Back in the 60s and 70s, new immigrants defined themselves by the country they came from. So my wife comes from Bradford in West Yorkshire, the north of England. About half of Bradford comes from Pakistan. And I remember when you get in a conversation, they'd say, "I'm Pakistani," if you ask them about it. Now they say, "I'm Muslim. I'm Islam." That's really significant. Really significant. It means that they're defining themselves by religion rather than by nation and race. That is a very significant thing, crucial for our understanding of the landscape. So between the issue of race and nationality, and religion, Islamic, is actually class. The majority of Muslims in Europe are young because of these high birth rates. So we have these young, largely urban Muslims in cities like Bradford and Paris, Utrecht. And the vast majority of these young Muslims belong to the underclass. They're part of welfare class. They live in relative poverty compared to the middle classes, and they don't have much chance of improving themselves. They're often in a poverty of education. The famous suburbs around Paris, they're almost like ghettos, surrounded by shells of factories that have sort of fallen into ruin. It looked quite dystopian when you see the pictures of them. Well, these young Muslims have a deep sense of belonging to the oppressed class. And that makes it very easy for them to identify with the Islamic world, because that's at the heart of the Quran. That's what Allah wanted, to inculcate the sense of being oppressed. And that really, really works for the oppressed classes of Europe where Islamic young people are. And it undergirds the point that for thousands of years, Europe has oppressed us. And this is where our part in the Crusades is deeply unhelpful. You can get Christian thinkers who can say, there's some things about the Crusades that we can't just capitulate. We had to do it. But overall, I'm not one of those. I think they were a disaster. And we're paying the price today for the Crusades in the sense of the oppression. It's been going on for a very, very long time. So, the point, Islamic identity in Europe is very much a social reality defined in a religious way. Now, I don't want to get into this, but when you define your oppression in religious terms, it ups the ante. This is more than Marxist. You put religion into the mix, and it gets much more potent and dangerous, potentially. So that's the brief historical sketch, a place of the three main players. Secular humanism firmly in the center ground, majority rule occupying, as I say, the center ground of Europe. Christianity, now a minority, marginalized. I think we can say we are the beleaguered. When an American tells me they're the beleaguered minority, I want to push back and say, not in a European sense. It's not the same. I think it's another subject again. I think we are entering a period of persecution. We are on the edge of that now. But in the last few decades, with this marginalization of Christianity, we've got this other presence, the blast from the past. The Muslims are back in the mix. And they're becoming more religious in terms of their sensibility with this idea of being oppressed within it. So that's a bit of a powder keg, isn't it? So let me now move on to a snapshot. Three players, brief history. So if we just take a picture right now of where it is with these three players, what does it look like? Well, I'm going to take all three quickly, talk about positive things in terms of their demography in Europe, and then look at the negative things, the things that threaten secular humanism, Islam, and Christianity, to give a picture, and we'll leave it at that. So let's start with Islam. Positive factors, in a sense, in favor of their presence and growing presence within Europe. What are the positive factors? Well, one is they have a positive demography. The numbers are good. They're having babies. They're growing. They're a growing presence. So numerically, Muslims in Europe have quadrupled between 1970 and 2000. That's huge growth. And projections into the future say they'll keep growing. Now, here's where things tend to differ amongst sociologists. At present, in Western Europe, Muslims make up 4% of the population. A little bit more than that. And there are still quite large areas of Western Europe where Islam has little or no presence. So it's not as if they're everywhere. I think looking forward to 2050, conservative estimates say the figure could go up to 15%. 4% to 15. Here's the warning. There are people out there, a lot of them Christians, who are scaremongering. They're in a kind of hysteria about all of this, and they're using a lot of fake news. Be careful. Beware. You sometimes hear, Europe is on the brink of becoming Eurabia. That's a pretty threatening idea, isn't it? And although it's very, very likely that Islamic population in Europe is going to grow, I think a lot of these predictions are crazy. And we'll see this on the other side, the negative. Their birth rates are actually declining quite rapidly now, too. So I don't like the Muslims are going to take over. And some American evangelicals have to say, love to feed that rhetoric. You got a Muslim mayor in London, and that's it. It's the start of the takeover. It's not careful in terms of what's really going on. Significant presence, a growing presence, but takeover, I think most demographers would say that looks unlikely. But who knows? So we have to be careful there. There's a positive factor. The other is their high level of commitment. High level of commitment. This commitment is inspired, as I said, by being the oppressed class. They're also dispossessed, the younger generation. We've just moved from a place in Cambridge, and we were the one little Bengali community in Cambridge, and we got to know some of them quite well. The older generation still remembered growing up in Bangladesh. The younger generation had no memory of that, never visited. They were dispossessed in that sense. And this dispossession actually increases loyalty to Islam. And the meaning for many young Muslims isn't connected to their birthplace, as we are global Muslims, and they have this global consciousness through social media of what's happening in other places, and this sort of stirs up their sense of passion and commitment to the cause. So they have a very strong sense of belonging to something. Deep meaning is actually in belonging. The problem with secular youth is they don't have much belonging. They don't know what they belong to. They might belong to a crowd for a while, but it's very fluid, their belonging. Not with young Muslims. There's incredibly high commitment. And I think that gives Islam a presence and a vibrancy that can't be ignored. There is high level of commitment. You see this in their building projects. If you want to see religious scapes, look at cityscapes. The way Muslims have built mosques in Europe is remarkable. The first generation who came in the 50s, they didn't do much mosque building. In 1966 in the UK, there were 18 mosques. The stats for 1997 is that there are 1,000. And since then, who knows? In places like Germany, they can't even keep count. I mean, because there's been such an explosion of building mosques. So that, you know, that shows the level of commitment. So they're part of the dispossessed. They're engaging social media. And it makes them part of this big narrative. And the big narrative is faith, belief, will defeat the infidels, unbelief. So it's very much part of their social identity. So there is a global Islam, largely internet-generated, that gives a sense of historical consciousness. They have that. We could talk a lot about this. Western people, especially of my children's generation, are ahistorical. I mean, a movie that came out last decade was something like happened centuries ago, where our memories are so short. Muslims tend to have long memories. And that gives high levels of commitment. What about the challenges and the threat, the negative side to Islam in Europe? Well, the first is the challenge of secular humanism. One of the great questions of our continent is this. It could be one of the biggest. Will Islam survive modernity? I mean, we haven't done terribly well as Christians. You could say we're still in that struggle. Will Islam survive modernity? It's such a mighty cultural force, as we've learned as Christians through hard experience. So take the issue of demography. At the moment, Islam has it on its side, but will they still keep having high levels of babies? And now they're saying, the demographers, it's tailing off because Islamic women are going to work. So it's likely their high birth rates won't continue. And what about the moral challenge of secular humanism? Just the pressure in terms of how we view marriage and sex. My understanding is that many young Muslims are very committed, but when it comes to their morality, drinking and sleeping around, they've taken on many of the values of the secular age. Will they be able to retain their very strong view from the Quran, the subordinate role of women? I know thinkers who say, actually, if women achieve equal status, it threatens the fabric of Islam. The whole thing would really shake if that happened. Well, pressures of secular humanism, will they survive that? So will they survive the pressures of secular humanism? Sex before marriage, easy divorce, what to do with same-sex attraction? That's their first challenge right there. Can they survive secular humanism and its moral challenges? The other challenge for Islam is competing voices to define its core within Europe. Because I've been using up to now Islam very generically, but the fact is, like Christians, there's many brands of Islam, and they're very divided against each other. And a lot of the discussion amongst Muslims in Europe is, what is their faith meant to look like on the European continent? And lots of different voices are vying for the center. So there's an ethnic diversity of European Muslims. Those of us who aren't Islamic tend to symbolize Islam through the Arab states. We somehow put it where Allah grew up, but that's just one shade and flavor of Islam. It's fed from lots of other different streams. Muslims from Morocco, who are quite different in their sensibility than Muslims from the Middle East, Turkey, Nigeria, different forms of practicing the faith. Which one's going to define the true expression of it? And then there's lots of competing voices from abroad, Saudi Arabia in particular. The Wahhabis use a language of reformation. They actually are looking for what Luther was doing. We have to reform Islam, take it back to its roots. They're putting huge amounts of money into the reformation of Islam in Europe. And their money is building the huge mosques. Then you've got the Sunni Shi'i conflict. I mean, they go to war against each other. Our religious wars did eventually die out, but theirs hasn't. Huge conflict between these two. Then you've got the Sufis. Some would say the Sufis are the mafia of the Islamic faith. They have such power, and they're the ones who I think can adapt to some of the European challenges and make it very attractive. But most Muslims hate the Sufis, but they have enormous influence. So the point is, there's a conflict again. And then there's the generational conflict. Many mosques in Bradford, where I lived for a long time, I could see the division between the older generation, who were quite moderate, and the younger generation, who were much more radical in their sensibility. The generation gap is a massive thing in the church today. It's a massive thing for Islam. So, some things that seem to favor how it could develop and grow, and other huge challenges. What about secular humanism? Let's take that one now. What are the positive factors for the future of secular humanism? And if you want me to tell you it's going to die in the next 10 years, it's not. It rules. It's completely shaped the fabric of Europe in terms of our institutions, of our thinking. Secular humanism is king. And I think despite the challenges, it will dominate Europe unless Jesus comes back or there's a revival even greater than the Great Awakening of the 18th century. I think it's going to be dominant for a long time. Now, who knows? Only the Lord knows. But don't think that this is just going to fall apart and dissipate. A lot of people say it's eating itself. I mean, the woke LGBT, you can see how it's turning against itself. But as an ideology, there's nothing to threaten it at the moment in a major way. So I don't think it's just going to roll over and die. It's king. What about negative factors? What are the challenges to secular humanism? Well, one I've already mentioned, and it's the challenge of religion. Secular humanists, I think, as they saw the momentum and as they begin to want to form the future, their dream was the naked public square, and it just didn't happen. And now religion, with this Christian thing that's always been there, and it just won't go away, it won't die, and all these Christian names and Christian spires. In Cambridge, I've got a few friends who are skeptics of a very high order. Christianity's offered nothing good to the world. Well, that's interesting. Let's walk through our city again and see what Cambridge might look like without Christianity. Jesus College, let's get rid of that. St. John's, let's break that down. I mean, yeah, it's in our landscape, isn't it? But so it's still a present. That's the point. And as I say, Islam there too. And secular humanism are really struggling with the challenge of religion. I think in terms of an ideology, it only works if religion completely goes away, but it's just here. And so the secular humanists can't ignore religion, so what are they going to do with it? The EU constitution, if it highlighted anything, is that the European elites, the great thinkers, didn't understand religion. There's hardly any reference to it as a constitutional document. You think, really? You're going to give a document for our continent that's supposed to unite us in terms of the EU and there's no reference to religion? I think that might be an oversight. What is secular humanism going to do with Christianity? As I said, this is Charles Taylor's idea. He's a Canadian-French philosopher, French-Canadian philosopher. Remarkable thinker. He says Europe is Christ-haunted. We're Christ-forgetful, but we're also Christ-haunted. You walk through a town looking at street names. Americans go First Street, Second Street, Third Street. But in Europe, we have named streets. And most of those names, many of them have some kind of religious dimension to them. James Street, Church Street. I mean, how many church streets are there in Great Britain? I mean, every town has a church street. Our calendar. Our calendar still reflects the Christian story. Christmas, Easter, helping us integrate time, our relationship to time, with the transcendent points that we need for meaning. What have the secular humanists come up in terms of holidays? Bank holidays. Oh, I'm so moved in my religious affections. I like a bank holiday, but it's a bit flat, isn't it? So they still use our calendar, and they can't offer anything better. That's the point. The other challenge to secularism, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the nature of liberalism within secular humanism, but there is a crisis of liberalism. There are so many threats to liberty today. So on the one, the secular humanism is desperate to keep liberty at the center. That's where they are, the bastard stepchild, because they got their ideas of liberty from Christianity. They took it from us, but how do they maintain liberty? So free speech today. We are seeing free speech legislated out of existence in the interest of liberty. It's a bit of a contradiction. So I think secular humanism tends to say it's libertarian, but actually its liberties are being destroyed. I happen to have a fairly dark sense of the future. We are going to quickly lose our liberty because secular humanism can't stand up to the threats. It doesn't have a basis for maintaining liberty. Right, let's leave it there because I want to get into the discussion. Finally, Christianity. When I say I'm going to leave the secular humanist behind, what about ourselves, Christianity in Europe? Let's start here with the challenges and threats. Start with the negative, but we're going to end in a positive. Not because we're given to positivity, which is the new religion of our times, because we have real positives to state. But let's do the negative first. The negatives, well, one is declining numbers. The trends in Europe are steadily downwards in terms of vibrant Christians who are part of churches. And this downward trend has been catastrophic. I mean, our continent is littered with beautiful buildings that are empty. Our little village we just moved to near Cambridge, this gorgeous big Anglican church in a tiny agricultural village with 7 people on a Sunday, all of whom are very old. They had to do a massive funding campaign recently to repair a little bit of the church. I mean, it is catastrophic. Declining numbers. The exception are evangelicals. Generally, many countries of Europe, there is some growth there, but let's not be triumphalistic about the growth. It's wonderful, but it's not as if we're going to take over Europe in 5 minutes' time. I don't like triumphalism. I like the fact that we can be triumphant in Christ and his promises, but this is not a moment for evangelical triumphalism. These are hard times we're in. So declining numbers. The other is the prevailing story in the media, in the sphere of the social sphere, that Christianity is the bad boy of Europe. We are responsible for all that is bad. You know, there is a creed out there, and I know this working in Cambridge amongst lots of academics and skeptics. It's ABC, anything but Christianity. And here's where, you know, I think the persecution is beginning. Different European states have different laws, but there are things which I think we must say publicly, and yet you're in church ministry. You begin to tremble now, even in a church. For stuff we would say, if someone's in the back hearing this, I could get in trouble for it. On issues around sexuality and gender, obviously, but I think other issues too, in terms of public discourse, if we can call it that, it's harder to do it. But the point is, we are caricatured as the producers of all things bad. Bam, bam. Secular humanism, and this goes way back, it's actually a deliberate ploy of philosophers in the 18th century. They reconstituted the creation, fall, redemption story. Creation of something beautiful and good was the age of the Greeks and Romans. That's the golden age, when people thought straight, created beautiful art, came up with republics and democracies. And then the fall happened. And what's the fall? Christianity, the Edict of Milan, bringing on the Dark Ages. That's how the story spun. the Dark Ages, which we're responsible for, the Catholic Church. And redemption is in the Enlightenment, which is the rise of the secular humanists. Well, we know the story, creation, fall, redemption, but that's twisted it up a bit, hasn't it? And it makes us the bad people. What we're doing in Cambridge with Christian Heritage is historical apologetics. Cambridge is a great place to do it. Rise of Modern Science, Cambridge. Let's go to Cavendish Laboratory and talk about the rise of science. Oh yeah, he was a Christian. Social reform. New liberals see themselves as the social justice warriors. Oh, let's tell a story here. Yeah, that guy there, just outside of St. John's Chapel, that's Thomas Clarkson. Yeah, he's the real father of the social reform movement, the humanitarian movement. Yeah, he abolished slavery. He did all the research. Oh, that guy over there who went to St. College, his name's William Wilberforce. Let me tell you his story. It's so powerful. And you know, secular people, wow. Educated people, like, I didn't know these things. History, I think we can use quite positively, because there are some things that no historian can revise in terms of historical understandings. Okay, those are the negative factors. What about the positive ones that favor our future? Well, the first is the promise of God. I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail. That's the hope. The Bible is full of promise. His glory will cover all the earth. There's no place for a Christian who's crying into their teacup in despair about how bad things are. Now, no positivity. I think things are worse than we really think they are. But as Simone Veil said, there's no better time to live than when everything is falling apart. Because we have a hope. It's a real promise. He's never broken a promise, and he has promised that his kingdom shall prevail. Now, we might have different interpretations, I'm sure, about how the end is going to work out, but it's going to be a good end. When I was a pastor in my 20s in Bradford, I had a group of young Muslims that I was talking to, and I finally got one to read the Bible. He said, okay, I'll read your Bible, because all the criticism, you guys believe in three gods, we'll just read the Bible, see if it says that. Finally, this guy's bright. He said, okay, I'll read your Bible, so I gave it to him. Didn't see him for a month, and we got together and had a chat. I said, how are you doing with the Bible? He said, I'm actually really enjoying it. Well, not surprising. What are you reading? He said, yeah, I've been reading Revelation. And I thought, oh. My one caveat should have been, read any book in the Bible, but don't read Revelation, because even Christians don't understand it. So I said, well, why are you enjoying it? But I knew this, but he said, I love science fiction. And he said, the fact that there is something that approximated science fiction I found interesting, but he said, it was just so clear. I said, I know great biblical scholars will take on any book but Revelation. He said, it's obvious, it just says you guys are going to win. That's what Revelation says, we're going to win. We miss it in all the detail. That is the message that we're meant to take away from the reading of Revelation. We have to hang on to that. Everything to be positive about. Christ will restore his glory. Here's where we are. We're the first continent to Christianize, de-Christianize, and the need now to be re-Christianized. It's never happened before. So we're in new space. But that makes it a little bit scary. But what is the re-Christianization of this? My view is the Southern Hemisphere. Africa, Asia, revival. As dark as it is here, what's going on there is amazing. There's an Indian bishop here. I said to my wife the other day, I had breakfast with a bishop. That sounds pretty impressive, doesn't it? 10 years in what he called the mission's graveyard, the missionary's graveyard, and he just persevered. 10 years, 3 conversions with many death threats, knives to the throat, his throat to the throat of his wife and daughter. He's here at this conference. Now is at 800 churches and almost 20,000 converts. In the last 20 years. Absolutely remarkable. Okay, so that's the first thing, the hope we have in Christ. The second positive thing is the weight of history. This is what I like about being Christ-haunted. This is a very, very Christ-haunted continent. As I said, in the architecture and the street names. And I don't think we can ever completely escape our historical consciousness. This is where the naked square was always going to fail, because it's so strong in us at one level. Even the most secular person can't escape this completely. Jürgen Habermas, part of what's known as the Frankfurt School, the famous neo-Marxist who came up with critical theory for the first time, he says Christianity and nothing else is the ultimate foundation of liberty, conscience, human rights, and democracy, the benchmarks of Christian civilization. To this day, we have no other option. We continue to nourish ourselves from this source. Everything else is postmodern chatter. Wow. Habermas. We could get into this, but we have a lot of allies who are not Christians. The most obvious today is Jordan Peterson. But look for allies who actually see what's going on. Then the other thing that I'll leave it here, there is in Europe new kinds of Christians. We've talked about the decline in terms of church in, attendance, but there really is a vibrant Christian witness in Europe today. I think it's as influential as it's been for many decades, maybe for the past 100 years. So we shouldn't confuse the institutional decline of the church with the uprooting of the faith. And while many nominal churchgoers have slipped away, I think those who have remained have become stronger in their faith. It's been fortified. So there's higher levels of commitment and dedication to Christ than ever before, well, not ever before, than there's been in many, many decades. So although we're minority, we're still much larger than the Islamic population. And I would say our minority status shouldn't be seen as a disaster. I often ask myself, what's my favorite period of the church's history? I think it's 2nd, 3rd century. Those guys were being persecuted, so they're a visible presence, but they're still so young. The idea of taking over culture would have been ludicrous. The idea, well, let's get a president into the Senate of the Roman and then we'll take it over. I mean, they couldn't even think in those terms. But what they did, what happened in the 2nd, 3rd century in terms of growth, because a few were so passionate. And they were passionate in terms of social reform. We've got to get the babies off the scrap heaps and bring them into our house. And you know what? We're going to be celibate. You know what celibate was back then? You only slept with your wife. You were a celibate person. It was radical. I'm reading a book right now, The Weirdest People in the World, which is basically about Christians. What turned Europe upside down? Monogamous marriage. Paterfamilias, one father, multiple wives, multiple children. You've got limited land. How do you leave an inheritance? How do you commit to all these wives at once? How do you commit to your children? It just created chaos. This guy says monogamy. He's a non-Christian. He doesn't like Christians. He's a Yale academic. He says it's monogamy, which actually turned the world upside down. A minority, second, third century. We shouldn't also fail to mention here the growth of immigrant churches. In Ukraine, I think the largest church was Nigerian in Kiev. I don't know if there's any Ukrainians here, but there's a very vibrant presence of Kiev. Is it? Yeah, interesting. And it's true in terms of London, some of the biggest churches are Africans, from African nations. So small, but an increased vibrancy. So lots of challenges, but we have everything to hope for.